You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Hello, and welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and today I'll be speaking with Jeff Scoop. Jeff has been on the program two times previously, once with a gentleman named Daryl Davis, and once by himself. And Jeff has a very interesting story. For 27 years, Jeff was a member of the National Socialist Movement, that is the largest neo-Nazi group in the United States, perhaps the world. And 25 of those years, he was the leader of that movement. And he's since left the movement, left it in 2019. And in 2020, he formed a nonprofit called Beyond Barriers that works actively to rid the world of that extremist, hate-filled ideology, and works actively to undo that, works with various peace groups, with the Simon Wiesenthal Center, with RAND Corporation, the Center for the Study of Violent Extremism, works with mental health professionals, and works with individuals themselves who are trying to get out of the movement, which is not as easy as saying, I'm leaving. I find my conversations with Jeff very valuable, and I hope you will as well. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. I'm David Bryan, and as I just told you in the introduction, I'm speaking with Jeff Scoop, a name some of you may have heard of. And Jeff, as I said, Jeff has an interesting story that which I'm mostly gonna let him tell it, but I will say I believe it was for 25 of 27 years you were in the National Socialist Movement, and for 25 of those years you were the leader. I don't know what the title was, director, leader, head guy. And the National Socialist Movement was at the time, and may still be, I don't know, the largest neo-Nazi group in the United States, maybe the world. And and Jeff has since left the movement, and hopefully you'll talk about that. So Jeff, it's good to see you again, and thanks for being willing to come back and have this conversation. And I don't want to spend too much time on what we already covered the first time we spoke, but if you would say something about how you got in and how and why you got out, and then we'll go from there.
Well, hey, David, thanks for having me back on the program. It's an honor to be here. And yeah, I was involved in the National Socialist Movement for 27 years, and 25 of the years I was the commander or the national director of the organization. It's a very regrettable past, you know. So that started off, and I'll try to kind of summarize it for any new listeners or anybody that didn't hear our previous interview, but it started off as a childhood fascination, you know, starting in about fourth grade. My grandfather had fought in the German army during World War II. My great uncles fought as well, and I was aware that our family was from, on my mom's side of the family, was from Prussia, and, you know, had come to the United States later. My mother immigrated, and my grandparents did after the war as well. And so knowing that family history is what was the entry point for me, which is a little bit different than a lot of Americans, you know, but it also can, that sort of thing can spread into other organizations. You have like generational clansmen and people like that, like they'll join the group because their family was involved in it. So for me, it was that initial fascination. I wasn't taught racism or hatred or anything like that growing up. It wasn't something that was tolerated in our home. It wasn't something that was promoted. And it was, but it was this, so it was, I'm to blame for it. I don't place it on anybody else. I don't say my family did this or anything like that. Mm-hmm. True. It is what started my fascination. And knowing about that family history sent me down that road. And then after I joined as a teen, 18 years old, then I started becoming radicalized and learning hatred and all that sort of thing, and rose up through the ranks rather quickly.
And was there when you say you became radicalized, was there an intentional effort on the part of people? Like, was there, you know, instructions in how to be hateful in that way?
No, not at all.
Just being surrounded by it.
Right. I mean, I call it radicalization now, but at the time I wouldn't have. At the time, you know, I thought I joined this awesome movement, you know, this noble cause, and that I was going to fight for my people and all that sort of thing. That's the way I viewed it. And most people that are involved in it do have that view. And you know, those of us looking from the outside looking in go, come on now, you got to know this stuff is bad. You got to know it's evil or wrong or it's not a good path to be on. But anybody that's involved in that sort of thing, they think that most of them, the vast majority, believe they're doing something good and noble. And this spreads across all sorts of extremism. You know, you could look at groups like ISIS even, and you think they're chopping off heads and doing things like this. And you think, man, they must know they're evil. But in their minds, they think they're doing God's work or Allah's work or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So it's the same concept, and it does apply across all forms of radicalization.
What was there a religious component to it? Was there not just sort of protecting your people, but was there a strong strand of whatever the religion was, Christianity, or that this is, you know, this is preserving whatever God means, right? Was that there as well?
It is, and it can be, but I mean, there's some nuance to that. So like in the group that I was in, religion was considered something that was for home, family, church, that sort of thing, because and that was actually a rule that I implemented, because early on that I saw that the divisiveness between the different religions in the white nationalist sphere, there was a lot of infighting there, which shouldn't.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
A very divisive movement as it is. So there was a lot of infighting. So I made sure to have rules about it, like worship as you will, but don't proselytize and don't push it on others. So because there is specific groups that are geared towards Christianity or geared towards paganism or geared towards other made up religions or like creativity, which is a white supremacist, like atheism type of thing. So you have a lot of different religious aspects of it, but definitely religion can be a key component, and it can also help solidify that involvement.
And without, you know, without having to repeat all that stuff that we've already spoken about, the at some point you got out and quite intentionally left and renounced the positions that you had, the attitudes, the understanding, the positions that you had taken all that time. So can you, you know, just like, how'd that happen? You know, without, I mean, you don't have to go through the whole story, but, you know, why'd you get out?
So it's a process. And for me, it took a lot of time. And for a lot of folks, sometimes it can be like a one and off event, you know, like you have this conversation or this grand epiphany. But typically it's a process. And for me, it was a long process that took several years before I actually broke free. But to summarize it and to put it into, you know, so there's a lot of smaller things that took place. But some of the biggest things that took place were very specifically like a meeting when I was in my role as the commander of the National Socialist Movement. I would do interviews and things just like what we're doing today. And I had an interview with a man by the name of Daryl Davis.
Sure.
And that was life altering for me. You know, I walked into it. I didn't even know I was meeting Daryl because I just thought I was going for an interview. And I was like, God, this guy, I recognize that face, the name, and it clicked. And I was like, oh, this is the guy that gets people out of Klan groups and things like that. So I just figured it's another day at the office. I'll square off against this guy and no big deal. And he planted seeds. Daryl planted some real seeds and really got me questioning things. You know, like I said at the beginning, I really felt like I was doing something good and noble. And Daryl didn't tell me that I was wrong, but he helped show me like how my cause, you know, caused damage and caused pain and suffering in other people. And that's something you don't think about. Most people don't think about, you know, unless you're a sociopath or something like that. You don't think about, you know, how it's hurting others. You're just thinking about, you know, I'm part of this great cause and I'm going to do these great things. And I didn't see it. And Daryl helped show, he showed me his humanity. And once you start hating other people or embracing racism and things like that, I feel like you lose your humanity in that process. So my humanity was lost for a long time, and he helped reconnect that.
And okay, so, well, before we jump to what you did and what you're doing today, et cetera, can you give us a little picture of, because I know some of your work is quite specifically about helping others who are in the movement who want to get out, to get out, to de-radicalize. So what does that process look like?
So yeah, that is some of the work that I do now. We work with de-radicalization, disengagement, getting people out of cults, hate groups, gangs, anything of that nature, and getting them on the right path. So the main process we use is something that I call relational dialogue. And this is basically having a framework of conversations. It has a lot to do with listening. It has to do with respect. Again, you don't tell people that they're wrong, even if they're just so off base wrong. You don't tell them that. You try to show them how they're wrong and give them examples and listen to them, you know, because everybody wants to be heard. Everybody wants to be loved. Everybody wants to be respected. And you have to go into those conversations like that. And you can't be passing judgment. You know, if you go into that and you're angry or you're getting offended or triggered or upset, or they say something mean and it hurts your feelings or something like that, you're not the right person to be doing that kind of work, because you have to have this. First of all, you have to be confident in who you are and what you stand for. And then you have to be able to listen, and you have to be able to understand where they're coming from. So a lot of times that's basically how it starts. It starts with that respect, and it starts with for a lot of them that reach out, it's a curiosity as well.
Do most people do people reach out to you, or do you show up and here's this guy who, you know, used to be doing what I'm doing. What the hell is he doing here? Like, how does that work?
Typically they'll reach out, and sometimes, you know, most of them won't reach out and say, "Hey, look, I need help." I wouldn't have done that either. You know, I mean, I think as men, I don't want to stereotype, but as a lot of us as men don't like to ask for help. It's just a reality. It's a truth for a lot of people. So that's not,
we don't even ask for directions, right?
Exactly. That's where I was going with it. Yes.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, they'll just reach out and they'll ask curious things, you know, like questions, or like, you know, why did you change? Or sometimes it'll start with that. It'll start a little bit with my story, and then I'll ask, well, what about your story and what makes you curious about it? Because truth be told, if they're reaching out and they're curious, even if they're a little bit hostile, I mean, if they're completely nasty, there's no sense in really engaging if somebody's just utterly nasty, but or making threats. But if somebody's, you know, making some jabs or rude comments, that's okay. But listening and being able to engage in that conversation. So a lot of times it's curiosity, like, well, why did you leave? Or are you a communist now? You know, or because they think extremists always think in black and white, no pun intended. They think in extremes. So if you're not with them, then you must have flipped to the extreme other side. So and at first that question was so prevalent. And I was like, man, what am I saying that's making people think I'm a communist? And I had to reel it back and go, Jeff, you thought like that too about people that left. You thought that way about everybody that left too. So don't, it's not anything that I'm saying. It's the mindset. So it's like, well, if you're not on this side now, you must be on the opposite, you know? So a lot of times when you help them work through those things and tell them like, look, you can leave that and still be on the right. You just don't be racist or hating people. And if I'm helping somebody leave far left extremism, it's the same thing. You can still be on the left. Just don't be out on those extreme fringes, no matter where you're at. Same with religious extremism.
Okay. So, I mean, you know, this is going to sound like a stupid question because it might be, but is it hard work? How long does it take? You know, when somebody reaches out, you know, are we talking about it's an exhausting 10-year process? Is it, you know, that somebody gets hit by a bolt of lightning and suddenly they're, I see the light?
There's no easy answer for that. For some people, I've known guys that have been out way longer than I have that still struggle with certain things. And then I know people that it's been that like bolt of lightning. It's been that one quick thing that changed their whole life and they don't think that way anymore. For most, it's a process. It takes time. Everybody's different. For some, it can be a lifelong learning experience. For others, it's it can be months. It can be a couple of years. There's no way. If somebody says, "Oh, this is how long it takes," they're lying. That's not.
Yeah, they don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah, so it's no answer for that.
Is there pushback? Pushback? Maybe they're wrong. Like the people who are trying to leave, trying to get out, de-radicalize, whatever you call it. Is there pressure, conscious pressure from those who are still steeped in the movement to, you know, to stop, to, you know, stop those thoughts, you know, et cetera? Is there, and what form does that take?
Well, yeah, that's why a lot of times and why I understand the cult mindset as well, because it's so similar. When you're involved in these things, it becomes your whole world, you know, depending how far entrenched you are. You know, if you're radicalized online, you know, that's one thing, you can walk away from the computer. But yeah, if you're radicalized in the real world and this is your crew, this is your family, or these are the people you hang out with and that you're around, a lot of times everybody else in your world is gone. A lot of these people are ostracized from their families or completely cut off, whether they've done that or their families have done that to them. You know, so, and they don't have friends that are outside that bubble. So it's very isolating. I can say from my own story, the first, especially 6 months or so after I left, was probably like the loneliest, most difficult time in my entire life that I ever had. It was so tough. You're processing all these different things, and then you've got people trying to pull you back into that world, you know, like, you know, come back, we need you, you know, and then it's like, that was your sense of being, your sense of purpose, where you were at. That's a hard thing to do. For me, I had to literally turn off the phone, you know, and not accept those calls, not look at the
email,
answer the emails. So for everybody, it's different, but that's one of the biggest struggles with getting people back on the right track too, they have to have like a new mission or a new sense of purpose. They don't have to, but it's very, very helpful. Like I know one guy that learned to play guitar and that was his thing. Another lady went into the Catholic Church and was really active with that, you know. So it really just depends, you know. It could be a hobby, it could be a new mission, it should be something.
Well, it's kind of a perfect segue to what you're doing now. It's just like so your next purpose, I'm assuming, was beyond, well, what became Beyond Barriers, yeah?
Yeah, so I started Beyond Barriers as a nonprofit, and that was basically something to help people leave those extremist groups and leave hate groups, cults, gangs, everything like that. You know, because at first when I started speaking out, and I was just overwhelmed with people reaching out, and I couldn't do it by myself. And I hadn't had any offers from any other existing companies. So I felt like, well, either I got to start turning people away or start something else and bring in, you know, friends and good people around me like Daryl Davis, you know, to help with some of that, which is exactly what we did. So there's that. And then I think the most important thing, one of the most important aspects of my work that I really feel passionate about now, besides that, is education, you know, is educating young people, speaking at schools, doing things of that nature, so they don't ever get involved in groups like this in the first place. You know, we're always going to have those kind of groups out there, and there's always going to be some people that just, you know, stay entrenched, and we can't, you know, stop all of it. But if we can educate people and show them that we've got a lot more in common than we do differences, despite superficial things like skin color or religion or different cultures and customs that we have more in common and bring people together, I think then that will save, we don't even know, thousands, millions of people maybe from not going into that lifestyle like I did.
And what form does the educate, like, how does that work? Is, you know, do you get calls from schools, school districts? What, like, or is it through some other venue? How does that work?
Sometimes schools will reach out on their own, but I'm a speaker with Conscious Campus, and they do a lot of school talks. Primarily, a lot of the majority of the school talks that I'm doing are with the Simon Wiesenthal Center, which I'm a consultant, educator, public speaker with them. And they're an internationally known human rights organization, Jewish human rights organization. And they tackle all forms.
Which is really, I got to say, it's really, that's so telling. You know, I mean, you can go online and find all sorts of people who think you're full of shit, right? I mean, they're out there, right? Like, sure. Oh, he's just doing this to get out from, liability from a lawsuit. He's like, you know, this is all bullshit. But it's, you know, you're, At least the way you told the story and where I bump into it and what I read is, you know, you were never known for being a racist. Much more so, you were anti-Jew, anti-Semitic. And yeah. So that Simon Wiesenthal Center is, you know, the fact that they are reaching out to you, employing you, you know, giving you gigs is really kind of remarkable and telling, very obviously, I mean, you know, you're not into wearing badges, but that's a badge you should wear. So
it's been such an honor, David. I mean, and the irony of working with Wiesenthal is incredible. And there's a great story that goes behind it too. When they first reached out to me, the moment, literally within days of my website going up, I had gotten a contact from Rick Eaton. Rick Eaton is their director of research and somebody that had followed my career, I guess you could say, in the movement for like 30 years or, you know, he's been there 30 years. We followed mine for as long as I was involved.
Yeah.
He reached out and said, you know, would you like to meet? And I'm looking at the email and I'm thinking Simon Wiesenthal Center. Those are the guys that went after Nazi war criminals and things like that. That's what they're known for in the past, especially. And, now they're involved in a lot more educational initiatives and things like that as well. But that was kind of scary. It's a little scary for me, you know? So I remember thinking, you know, like, wow, this is really interesting. I had no idea they had anything to do with educational things. I said, I'll go meet with them. And I remember telling my girl, you know, and this was like latent paranoia from the movement. But I remember saying, if I don't come home, it means I'm on a forced extradition to Israel to stand trial. Yeah, I laugh about it now. And it's like, I knew it wasn't, you know, that wasn't the case because I hadn't done anything illegal or anything like that. But it was a little nerve wracking. And you're right. You know, it's like when I was in the movement, I was known for like spewing, like being a virulent anti-Semite. You know, so the irony of the guy that used to run the Nazi party working with a Jewish human rights organization, it almost had to pinch myself every time. And they're so incredible, such an incredible organization doing such great work. And it's so inspiring because they're like with the combat hate program, they're going into schools. We're talking to youth as young as a lot of times I'm speaking to youth as young as like sixth grade through high schools. And in inner cities, everywhere in different places across the country, we've done a lot of inner city talks and New York City and different Chicago and different parts of the country. And it's really wonderful to be able to help, you know, you.
Do you, when you run into that, when you work in that context, give talks to whatever groups in this or that, when through them, do you run into people in the audience who are just either they're not having it or there's so much resentment that they don't want to have it, right?
Very rarely. The vast majority of the time, it's been very well. It's went very well. There might be like one person occasionally that'll ask a question and go, well, I don't know if I really believe this, or I've had instances, but I'd say, you know, like 99% is good, but I've only had a few, couple instances that were kind of negative. And I've had a lot of interesting conversations, especially I really like engaging with the audience. To me, that's the best part, you know, cause you get everybody participating and stuff. And I've had, students and adults both at talks come up afterwards at a lot of things and say, I recognize you from television, or I seen you at this thing, or, mm-hmm. I spoke at a government conference just a few weeks back, and I had a lady come up and said, I used to write reports on you for the organization that she was with, and
oh, wow.
all this, and to see you here today speaking on behalf or speaking with a government agency, Office of Juvenile Justice, it was just amazing. And she gave me a hug, and it was just incredible. It's just the irony of it, and the it's just been a blessing. It's been truly
yeah.
a blessing. Be able to do this work.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, but maybe you just answered it. I was going to ask you about what the process is of, or are, you know, do you think of it this way as sort of making amends? But you're, in some ways, your work now is making amends, right? It's, you know, it's trying to undo some of the stuff that you were instrumental in doing. So.
That is how a lot of how I feel about it, because I wanted to, you know, repair some of the damage that I'd done in my past life. I try not to live in that space, you know, and beat myself up over it, because one can't change the past, but we can move forward and do positive things. And I feel like just the sheer amount of people I've helped walk away and on the educational side of things, you know, kind of enlightening people and stopping them from going down those paths has been phenomenal. And I can tell you at some of the school talks, I've had teachers say, hey, we've got this student. And there's one in particular I remember where the young man wasn't in the auditorium because his class wasn't the one that I was speaking to. And they're like, do you have time before your next talk to stay after? And would you meet with him in the office? You know, so I sat and I've done that a couple of times at talks. Mm-hmm. You know, we're spend a little extra time with the student or come back and talk with some of them one-on-one, because a lot of them will ask questions and get questions going, but sometimes they'll come up afterwards, especially if it's something they feel like, well, we don't want to embarrass you by saying, hey, I saw you on TV or things like that. They just don't want the other students to hear it. So they'll come up and have conversations.
You're sort of pointing at it. I'm wondering, you know, what is it? Are there things that parents, teachers, adults who, you know, work with kids, whatever, you know, what should they, what are they not understanding about the process of radicalization? What should they be aware of that they tend not to be?
Well, there's so much, especially young people nowadays, they're being bombarded with so much stuff, information from everywhere, whether it's TikTok, Instagram, you know, whatever, your social media stuff. It's just so quick and it's so fast and the algorithm and all that. So like one of the thing with the Justice Department and the OJJDP that we've done with this curriculum, which is one of the things that I was demonstrating, I was one of, I think it was 11 educators from around the country that was selected to be trained in DC for this this curriculum. And then we delivered it at schools. I delivered my portion here in Detroit and then showcased it in Birmingham, Alabama a few weeks ago with the Justice Department there. One of the specific things that program works on is teaching kids the difference between disinformation, misinformation, and malinformation, and how to engage online and how to discern these different things and use those critical thinking skills, you know, so you don't just automatically say, well, you know, this influencer or whatever is great and I believe everything they say. You know, it helps the students like fact check these things and look into them and use that sort of thinking and then find the differences between that. So very positive program.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. It does seem like it's overwhelming, and I think a lot of times parents don't. You know, it's not their world, and I don't mean the world of extremism and hate. I mean the world of social media. You know, it's the kids' world. It's not. It's not our. We get to visit now and then, but you know, they are residents. We are aliens who visit, and. I don't think a lot of adults understand the intensity of, with which that is their social, right? That, you know, it's their online world. That online world is not an online world. It's their world. It's incorporated into their, and the speed and the skewed attention that comes out of that because of what you just said. The algorithms are, you know, oh, you like this? Oh, you like this? There's more of that. Oh, there's more of that. Or there's more. And pretty soon it's like, that's your feed. Yep. And here it is. This is your social world. And I don't know if parents understand that. And kids are vulnerable. You know, they are. They're not fully formed yet. So it's really important that you're doing what you're doing. So I'm glad. And I'm glad this, I hope this curriculum becomes, you know, if it's where it's effective, I hope it becomes something that is offered more because we're living in this climate, which I would be remiss if I didn't invite you to have a conversation about the, you know, we spoke about this when maybe it was almost a year ago, right? I mean, we live in a polarized world. And now, as the elections, oh please God, let it be over. But as the elections come, you know, are coming hot and heavy, and it's so close, and all that, you know, I'm wondering if you're disturbed by the rhetoric that, you know, look, there's rhetoric on both sides, and both sides say things that are just not realistic, but there's one side that is, you know, and I don't need to mention Trump, but everybody knows that it's, you know, so much of what comes out of that campaign is so reminiscent of language that one can, you know, look back at the rise of the, you know, the Nazi party in Germany and the calling names and the vermin and the, you know, these people are vermin and these people are poisoning our bloodline. And I'm wondering if you feel like that is affecting, well, is it doing anything to fan the flames of extremism? Does that concern you and does that worry you? Yeah.
Now to answer your question on the political polarization in the country, it's gotten to the point, I think, now where I see it coming from both sides. I don't like to point fingers and say it's one side is worse than the other. Even if one side is worse than the other, I don't like to play that game, you know, just because it's the way I approach things and I try to be as moderate as possible.
But, I understand that. But
what we're seeing in this country, what it's done, has split up families, has split up people that, and we're not even talking about extremism. We're talking about like mainstream political parties here, where someone goes, right, well, if you voted for this guy or this person, I'm not talking to you. You're not my friend anymore. Or I'll unfriend you on social media and in real life, you know? And this is something that we're seeing a lot more of, I think, in more recent years, and it's deeply troubling. So the same concepts that we talked about, you know, briefly about like relational dialogue and how to have conversations with people can be applied in these situations. They can and should be applied in these situations. So if you have a neighbor that's voting for somebody you don't like or a family member that you don't like, and all of a sudden they're not welcome at Christmas or Thanksgiving or things like that, it's like, ooh, that's a problem, you know, like. Yeah. Why does it have to be like that? You know, and let's foster these conversations and understanding. And even if we don't agree on everything, I mean, that's one thing that's great about being an American is you don't have to agree on everything. We have this, you know, wonderful thing called democracy. And
Well, I think, I mean, I don't disagree. I really don't disagree with that at all. I think it feels important to me to name the, to point out the parallels, right? I mean, it's the specific rhetoric. Yeah, I mean, you know, both sides say things, you know, they call him unfit and they call him whatever it is, right? You know, he's incompetent, he's whatever, he's an extremist, he's a fascist, he's a whatever. And so it's not that, it's more what is so disturbing to me is the parallels in the language and language selection. That, you know, when you're talking about immigrants as poisoning the blood of the country and the enemy of the people and vermin, and, you know, which is so reminiscent of times past and you know, leading up to World War II, which God knows, we hope we don't have that, but it's so. And I, you know, maybe it's just language and it's not that effective, but the, I mean, I know I've read, I couldn't tell you where, but I know I've read that various currently active hate groups, right, white nationalists, et cetera, are using that language, are pointing to the language that is coming out of the campaign as reflecting their ideas. And I feel like that's qualitatively different than, you know, political campaigns. People say things, I'm better than you. No, you're not. You're incompetent. You didn't do this. No, yes, I, whatever. It's the intensity and the presence of that sort of discourse that seems so disturbing. And, you know, so I don't need you to say, you know, vote for Harris or vote for Trump or whatever, but it's good to hear that, you know, you think that that's poisonous for sure. When it really, I mean, and I know it does. I know families that have, you know, how do I deal with my brother now? They're like, well, he's still your brother, right? Or my neighbor, or, well, I mean, he's still my neighbor, and, you know, we help each other out. And
well, and like you mentioned too, like some of that really hard rhetoric, like vermin, and it's dehumanizing. That's dehumanizing rhetoric. And when you do that to somebody, it's dangerous. I feel like that kind of rhetoric specifically is dangerous. You can say somebody's incompetent, you know, and that's fine, I think. But when you start saying, you know, like these people are vermin, using that kind of language, that kind of borders along, or I don't even know borders. It is dehumanizing language.
That can
lead to things, because in an extremist environment, when you dehumanize somebody, then now they're not human, you know, they're less than. And this goes back to what I said, like, about ISIS chopping off heads. How does a normal, what might have seemed like a normal person, go from, you know, having a family and being an everyday normal person to chopping off someone's head? It's right. Because they're radicalized, and because they see that person as an infidel or somebody that's less than human. That's the only way you can do it, unless you're a psychopath or a sociopath. That's the only way your mind can convince yourself that it's okay to do something like that. So that kind of rhetoric is dangerous, and I do agree with you on that. We have to be careful about. It's one thing to criticize somebody, but I think there's certain language that can lead to that dehumanizing is really bad.
Yeah, and I just to be clear, you know, I live in a state that is very red, right? I mean, they vote politically very red, and they don't like Joe Biden, and they don't like Kamala Harris, and whatever, and I've not heard any of them use that sort of language, right? But I mean, who knows? Maybe they do it privately, but you know, we disagree about this or that, and that's fine. And then we have a beer, you know, or we disagree about this and that, and then we go plant that tree together, and like whatever that is. And that seems to me healthy. We find out, you know, it doesn't take very long to find out we have so much more in common than we do, you know, differences. And yet it sort of happens in this world where, you know, we're some of the most influential people. That's where the language is coming from, the most influential people. And that's what strikes me as, you know, it's nice to hear you say that, that is dangerous, because it really is dehumanizing. And am I dehumanized by hearing it? No. Are you? No. But there's somebody out there, right? Like, we know that there are people out there who get dehumanized, and that's part of it. So it's, you know, it's almost like pointing them in the right direction, in the wrong direction. So.
Well, and you know, those kind of things, that using that kind of rhetoric, it's like it gets clicks, it gets attention. And I think that some of these folks that use it, they know that. It's like, there's other ways to do that. Like, you don't have to use that dehumanizing rhetoric. You know, you can get your point across without doing that. So I think leaders and anybody that's trying to influence others, you know, they should be cognizant of that and try not to do that, to do their best to do that, because it sets a poor example. It's like they say, you know, like the old saying about, you know, sticks and stones, you know, may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. But words can hurt, you know, in that sense, when you start using that dehumanizing rhetoric, because it can escalate.
Well, Jeff, it's you know, I know it's, you know, we could use more time. We could, I know this conversation goes on and on and on, but what is something that you wish you'd said if we stopped now? Oh, geez, I should have talked about whatever. I'm glad you said the thing about curriculum, and I will absolutely put it up there. And I love that you're doing more work with kids in schools, you know, or at least that's the goal. So. Is there anything that feels incomplete about at least this piece of the conversation?
I think, I mean, the only other thing, I think, like, right now, you know, we've got a lot of political polarization going on in the country, but you also have some, you know, specific political issues, like the Israel-Palestine thing, you know, and people have gotten really whipped up over that and going at each other in different ways over that. And it's like, you know, everybody's got their positions and where they stand on different things. And again, we have to get back to this humanistic approach where we can see the humanity in one another. And if we're incapable of doing that as a society, that's what leads to those, you know, to things like genocides and horrible things.
And, you know, I don't want to coax you into a conversation you don't want to have. I know you just say I'm not doing it, but I was wondering about the Israel-Palestine thing and where you are in that, because, you know, it's disturbing. It's, look, what happened on October 6th, 7th is disturbing. It's horrible, and what's happening now feels horrible, and, you know, the pain and the suffering and it's. I'm not sure words like genocide help the situation. And it is in some ways ironic that what roles people are playing, what roles sides are playing in this tension. But it's I know it goes on that Palestinians and Israelis are sitting down with each other. But boy, we sure don't hear about that. And it sure does seem like a harder, and the longer this goes on, it feels like it's going to be a harder and harder. It's harder and harder to get back to the place where we can disagree, they can disagree, and then have a beer or whatever the drink is of choice.
It is a very difficult thing. And you know, I had the honor of meeting some of the hostage families in New York this year earlier. I think it was in June. Where they had come out and they had met with the Wiesenthal offices there, and then they were going on to speak at the UN either later that day or the next day. But it was one of the few times when I had no words. Like, I just was quiet and listened to their stories and feel their pain and their suffering about, you know, where either family members being missing. That was tough. you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's the human side of things that a lot of people don't think about. They think about, you know, the political agendas that are on the table and all that. They don't think about the human cost and what that does to families and how that makes them feel. And so that was incredibly
important. Did they know who they were speaking with?
I was just listening. I was mostly just listening, but there was like city council people there, and they all knew who I was, but I'm not sure. City council, yeah, the city council in New York do a lot of work with Wiesenthal, so I know a bunch of them out there, so that was interesting. And there was a few that I hadn't met, so I met them there, and I talked with them, but I didn't talk a lot with the hostages, families.
The families, yeah.
And all in. It is one of those things where it's, what do you say, you know, to them? It was really moving and really incredible experience.
Yeah. And it's that, you know, what you were talking about at the beginning of this conversation, it's the, you know, how does somebody get to the point where they're, where they can see, where they see the person on the other side, but they don't see a human being. They see something else. And so you can capture them, and so you can kill them, and you can murder them, and you can do all sorts of things in both directions, right? I mean, it's like they're not people. They can't be people that you would be doing this to. So...
That's the poisonous rhetoric that emanated in the neo-Nazi movement as well. You know,
that's why I'm asking you.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, I know all about this because I lived in that world and I understand it. And that's what we're sitting down with Daryl Davis and being able to see his humanity and him sharing how racism and hate affected him as a child. And same thing with when I had met Dia Khan, the Muslim filmmaker, soon after.
Yes.
It was the same concept, and being able to see that now all of a sudden you've got this cognitive dissonance where you're like, oh, my beliefs aren't aligning with this, because, you know, you had to separate yourself from that. Like whenever there was a mass shooting or a bombing or something like that, the first thing I did as the leader in the movement was I'm looking through the membership rolls going, oh my God, I hope this guy or, you know, this person isn't a member. You know, and checking through the lists. That's not normal, but that's the kind of stuff that was going through my head at the time. And then it was always like to mentally cope with it or process that. And there's a lot of psychological things going on for folks that are wrapped up in this stuff. So a coping mechanism for a lot of us, because you'd have some people like when those kind of things would happen, they would be like, good, you know, I'm glad it happened. And then the other half of the people would be like, no, it's not good. That's wrong. You know, they were innocent. They, you know, it wasn't like we're going off and fighting this war. These are just like innocent people that got cut down in this attack. That's not right. And I was always in that camp where I didn't feel like it was right, but I disconnected from it. Where I would say like, oh, the guy must have been crazy. You know, he was mentally ill. That's why they did that. He was sick in the head. There was something wrong with him. Or it wasn't one of our members that did it, you know, and there was members that did bad things as well, you know, so that kind of, you know, kicked that wall down. But most of the time when horrible things would happen, you would disconnect from it and just be like, well, that individual was crazy. Instead of going, you know what, this ideology might be driving people to do that. That was a hard one for me to swallow. And when I did, that's when I started saying, I got to get away from this. This is not me. This is not the kind of person I am. This is not what I believe in. It's not good. It's not healthy. And then to convince others of that as well. It's and back to your question earlier, you know, it's like, I don't typically won't go and seek out these people, you know, like you don't go to a rally or something and show up and try to convert
people. Yeah.
Right. It's not going to work. But, you know, if you have the chance to engage with them in other capacities where it's not a volatile environment like that, a lot of times you can get through it can be life altering. And you can't worry too much about, like you mentioned, you know, there's people that have doubts and things like that. I used to really let that bother me really bad, especially at first. I think, man, I put took my gave up everything I was doing, my business, everything I had built my life around, everybody I knew, and to try to make things right and set things right. And there's still people that doubt me. Oh, it made me so mad, and I would get so upset and feel, you know, just completely mad and sad and hurt and just like, well, what else could I do, you know? Now I look at it, you know, I understand it a little better. I understand the psychology of it, and I have more empathy, and I feel like it's fair, you know, to look at it from the outside going in. But if you have that conversation, or if you look into a person's background, like, first of all, I wouldn't be, you know, I got vetted by the Wiesenthal Center. I'm doing stuff with the government in some cases. I wouldn't be doing that stuff if I wasn't legit. I mean, they wouldn't.
No, but it's, I think it's another instance of what you know so well is that, you know, hate, it's part of what hate breeds, right? Hate breeds that sort of, you, the other side cannot see. It takes a long time for somebody to see past your hate, their hate of what you were, or right, and it's that, it's like the legacy of hate and the legacy of extremism. It's like, you, like you said, you know, it's a process. You got to live through it, work through it, and there's no time frame, right? Some people may go to their grave just thinking you're full of shit, and look, that guy, once a Nazi, always all that, whatever. And you know, what can you do?
You have to be accepting of that. And that's something that I tell other formers too, because other former extremists, you know, because I know it really bothered me at first. It doesn't so much anymore. It still does to an extent, but I understand it. And there's certain people that have said, you know, like, I've met with people that have lost loved ones, brothers, sisters, family members to people that have been in the movement, you know, or I even met a survivor of a school shooting, or he was in a Jewish daycare center. He was like 7 years old and got shot 3 times. And I met the guy that shot this person that did that shooting, you know, when I crossed, I didn't know him well, but I crossed paths with him in the movement. And, you know, to meet one of the victims from something like that, and that's not the only one, but to meet people like that, be able to sit down with them and to have them, you know, be okay with, you know, because the first thing that goes through my mind is, are they going to be okay with meeting me? Is that going to be something that they can do? You know, so these are a lot of things, you know, using your like emotional intelligence and all that, and being conscious of other people's feelings and how it might affect them. There's been talks where I've been at where people have come up and say, I recognize you from this documentary or whatever. I came in and I froze, and I was like, wanted to walk out, but I listened. And then afterwards, I wanted to come up and share with you that I changed my mind.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's just a matter of, you have to be in the right mental state to be able to accept somebody's change, and not everybody can do that.
No,
those of us have to be okay with
that
on understanding.
You bet. Well, Jeff Scoop, you know, I'm really, as I said before, I'm really glad you're doing what you're doing. I'm sorry you got there with the path you did, but you know what? We all have paths, and I'm proud to know you, and that you are working in for good, and I really appreciate you giving up your time to be here.
Well, it's an honor, and I really enjoy your show, and you're doing great outreach, and
cool, man.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been an honor.
Thank you.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryant here on LA Talk Radio.